Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is engineer Tony Shepherd. First of all, let's talk about Brexit and how it's going to affect the music business. Now, record labels already are complaining, especially English record labels, that a lot of their costs are going to go up as a result of Brexit. They say that their labor costs are going to go up and their office costs are going to go up, especially when it comes to having offices on the continent, offices in Germany, offices in France. And while that's possible and probably true, one of the things that people overlook is the fact that the record business is run by a bunch of streetwise executives that know how to make lemonade out of lemons. And they've done this many times before. And let me give you some examples. The big one, of course, is George Martin. Yes, Sir George Martin of Beatles fame was the first independent producer. Now, up until the end of George Martin's stay at EMI, he was just an employee, as all record producers were. It was just a staff job, and the record labels basically paid them a salary. And if they're lucky, they get a bonus at the end of the year. Now, George Martin in 1969 sold almost $1 billion worth of records for EMI and didn't even get a bonus. So he quit and became the first independent record producer. And as a result, now the record labels are paying two royalties. They're paying one to Sir George and all the other independent producers. Suddenly, everybody wanted to be indie, so there was a whole bunch of indies, and now the record labels are paying two royalties. So how did they get around it? What they did was they pawned it off on the artist, and they basically said, okay, from now on, you are responsible for paying the record producer. If you want to use an independent record producer, no problem. It just comes out of your royalty. And that's the way it's been until now. And the record labels made out like a bandit on that because now they cut their employee costs down. They didn't have to pay benefits any longer or a salary to the producer. So that's one example. A second example is the recording fund. What started to happen in the late 70s, early 80s, and really into the 90s was that record budgets were getting bigger and bigger. And as they got larger, there was more and more accounting. So what ended up happening was all of the invoices for a project were paid by the record label. And the costs of doing that were pretty enormous from the standpoint of they needed a lot of manpower to pay all of these bills that were coming in. And, you know, you have the big bills like the recording studios, of course, but you also had the small ones as well, the rental bills and the individual musicians. As a result, it took a long time for a vendor to get paid. And they started to complain to the producer, and they started to complain to the artist, and the artist would complain back to the label. So no one was happy with that situation, and what ended up happening was the record labels basically said, okay, we have a new deal for you. We're going to just give you a lump sum of money and call it a recording fund, and now you pay all the bills. So now the artist was responsible for paying all the bills, but if the artist actually came in under budget, they get to keep the rest. So this was an incentive for the artist to really do it well. And also, if the artist really wanted to take all that money instead of spending it on a studio, they could buy gear and start their own studio, which many did and continued to do. So all of a sudden, there's no more invoice problems, at least for the record labels. If there was an invoice problem, it was because it was due to the artist not paying. So now the headache was pawned off on the artist. So you can see how the record labels tend to take something that is not working in their favor and they turn it around so it works in their favor. Now, what I suspect what will happen is the record labels will continue to have offices, but they won't pay for it. Basically, what they'll do is they'll get independent contractors in all of those countries, and they'll basically say, it's up to you to open up a satellite office. You're an independent contractor. And that will work out better for the record labels. So this is what I suspect will happen. They'll end up smelling like a rose when it's all said and done, because let's face it, that's what record companies do for the most part. And we shouldn't be surprised when that happens. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget to check out my brand new Brand Your Music Crash Course. as well as my 101 Mixing Tricks program and my other online video courses. Go to BobbyOsinskiCourses.com to learn more. The next thing I want to talk about is a cable called the VariCap. This is by a company called Undertone Audio. And Undertone Audio basically makes boutique audio gear. And they made this unique cable. What it does is it changes the capacitance of the cable. So there's a 15-position switch on it that you can change the capacitance of the cable, and that changes the way it interfaces with your guitar. And as a result, the sound changes. And it sounds like you're rolling off the top end, but in a way that you really can't do it with the EQ. It's very, very interesting. It's about $100. I think it's about 10 feet long. It's not that outrageously expensive when you compare it to other boutique high-end guitar cables, but it raises the question, are there too many choices when it comes to tone? I bring this up because how many times have you seen a guitar player who will only use that one single guitar, will always have the tone controls on the amplifier up all the way or at a certain position and never change them, will never change the tone control on the guitar, and in many cases won't even use a different pickup selection. So I know a lot of guitar players, especially in the hard rock and metal realm, that what they do is they just set it on the rear pickup and that's what they use all the time. Now, of course, in a studio, what we want all the time is a different sound so we can layer guitars together and layer instruments together. And the only way we can really do that is if we change the sound of each instrument. So it makes it very difficult when you have the same guitar sound over and over and over on different parts. They all kind of blend together. Even if you have them in different registers, it just doesn't sound as good as when you have different amplifiers and different guitars doing, you know, different parts, even the same parts in doubles. There are some guitar players that can't get that through their head that it sounds better, and usually these are guitar players that don't have a lot of studio experience, but nonetheless that happens. So now you look at a cable that gives you more tonal capabilities, even though that 15-position switch, for the most part, it's what I heard most was when it was at 0 and 15, and you really heard a big difference between those two, and everything else was a lot less. But nonetheless, we come to that point where you go, how much is too much when it comes to variables? How much time do we actually want to spend looking for the minutiae in a cable as compared to just going out and changing the amplifier, changing the guitar, or making a radical change on the tone controls of the amplifier? I don't know. I haven't tried this cable, to be honest with you, but it looks very cool. I'd love to hear from anybody out there that does try it, and I'd love to hear your opinion. Have we hit the threshold of too much, or is there never too much when it comes to variables? My guest today is Tony Shepherd, who's engineered and mixed projects for a variety of household names like Whitney Houston, Kenny Loggins, Barbara Streisand, Michael Jackson, Lionel Richie, and many more. Tony also has his own record label called Breath of Life. It's about to get into the world of audio hardware with the launch of a very cool new summing box. I spoke with Tony via phone from his studio in Los Angeles. How did you get into the business? How did you get to be the engineer that you are? And I know it's a journey, but I'm not sure how you started.
Well, when I was 12 or 13, I started listening to a lot of Earth, Wind & Fire records. And I realized at that point in life, I wanted to be a recording engineer. I've always wanted to be a recording engineer. And when I, you know, back then you'd say that to people and they'd say, you want to what? you want to do what? Like, I want to record music. I want to mix music. It's a passion I have. So I always knew I wanted to do it. And my father wanted me to go to a four-year college. And back then, there was no such thing as a degree in music engineering. So I went and went to Loma Linda University and took photography as my major and business as my minor. And stepped out of college in 1986 and opened up my own studio. Started with a Lin 9000 and a Mirage.
Wow. Yeah.
That's how long ago it was. And then, a DX7. And then I got a partner and we took out a loan and we bought a used Sinclair.
Jeez.
And yeah, we bought a used Sinclair. And I remember the first hard drive we bought was a used hard drive for, it was a 10 megabyte hard drive for $2,500.
Oh, yeah. And you got a deal.
Yeah. We got a deal with those old Winchester hard drives. And it was so, you know, leapfrog from that, opened up my own studio and opened up a, you know, had one studio and then that turned into another studio, and you know, they jumped from 1,000 square feet to 2,000 and 3,000 square feet. And then in 91, a good friend of mine who was in the group Take Six, Mervyn Warren, called me up and said he was looking at resigning from Take Six and wanted to know if I wanted to come down to Nashville and work with him on projects. And I was like, yeah, let's do something. So I moved down to Nashville in 91 and worked on one project for the entire first year I was down there.
Gee.
For Warner Brothers. One project.
Wow.
And that was done. And we were done with that project. Warner Brothers literally shelved the project and said, this is nice. Okay, go do something else for us. And I was like, what? It's a year of my life.
Yeah.
And but the next project we worked on, we took 2 weeks off, and the next project we jumped into was a project called Handel's Messiah, Soulful Celebration. And the following year, that went to the Grammys. And I won a Grammy the next year when Disney was just getting ready to make a follow-up to a Whoopi Goldberg movie, Sister Act 2. They were making the follow-up, Sister Act 2, to the original Sister Act. And they called up Mervyn and asked him if he'd like to do the music for it. So we packed up the house. For a while I was commuting, but packed up and moved back to L.A. and been back in L.A. ever since 93. Just in time for the Northridge earthquake.
Yeah, lucky you, huh? I went through that myself.
Since then, it's been, you know, oh my gosh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's one of those days you just never forget.
No kidding.
Especially if you're anywhere in the valley. It just was just horrific.
I was living in Van Nuys at the time. I remember walking outside and looking at the light poles move back and forth like 6 feet and going, wow.
Yeah. I was living in Van Nuys too. And it was horrific. It just felt like there were demons over the house. And just shaking the house severely. And I just was like, what the hell is going on? I mean, it was a roar. I've been around earthquakes before, but never like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So, since then, it's been one thing after another.
What was it like in comparison to Los Angeles working in Nashville?
You know, I have a lot of fond memories of Nashville. I really do. And I have a lot of really good friends down there still that I keep in touch with on a weekly or daily basis sometimes. Long-lasting friendships. The studio system down there is a little different, and it took some getting used to because, you know, back then Music Row was basically it.
Yeah.
There were two rows of music, you know, two streets on Music Row. And pretty much if you had a studio, you were on one of those two streets pretty much. And the studios were made out from houses that had been converted. So it was completely different than what I was used to in LA.
Yeah.
I think I got along so well with so many of the guys because I was not doing country. So I wasn't a musical threat to them. I wasn't taking a gig or anything from them. It was just, you know, we just hit it off because, you know, Nashville's a friendly place until it's not.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
As long as you're not taking a gig from somebody, it's all great. And I wasn't a threat to those guys.
Yeah.
But I love Nashville and have, you know, I considered for many years moving back to Nashville because it was a lot of fun. But the town has changed.
Oh, big time. Well, Music Row is so small now. Vanderbilt owns most of what used to be Music Row. I've always found it to be a very cosmopolitan city in terms of music. You know, everybody automatically thinks of it and they think of country music. But every time I've been there, I've found that there was a lot more different styles that you'd hear. You'd just go out and you'd hear all sorts of different music, and people are doing different things in the studio, and it was very cool.
Yeah. And you'd also get a lot of people coming over from Atlanta or Memphis. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It wasn't just Nashville. So you're 100% right. I just Nashville has this picture of being one style of music, and it's not that. It's a pretty cool place. I'd go back there in a heartbeat. I have a lot of friends. I have a dear friend that just passed away a month ago, Bill Heath, who was manager of Digital Recorders. Norbert Putnam had Digital Recorders, and at the time, we used to go from room, we had two or three rooms booked at any given time, depending on what we were doing. And Bill and I hit it off, and even after I left Nashville, Bill and I just remained super close friends. So, I love Nashville.
You must have been a popular guy keeping three rooms booked.
Well, you know, it was weird because we would start mixes, and then Mervin would say, oh, you know, we've got to do so-and-so, so-and-so, and such-and-so, you know, and it's like we'd pop to another room. So we'd have orchestral dates in one room and then keep the mixes going in other rooms. And then we'd be set up to overdub in a third room. At the time, they had these penthouse up in Digital Recorders. So they had two mix rooms. They had a quad eight room that was great for overdubs, and Mervin kept that for his productions. And then I would be mixing in the knee V room, at the time it was just a V, and then we would have the orchestral room. We would be, you know, using that, you know, throughout the day. So yeah, we were very popular.
yeah, definitely.
At the time we were very popular. So,
well,
but you know, also back then we were recording with WSR and then dumping to 48 track.
Yeah.
So we were using a multiple of formats back then. So yeah.
Wow. Well, let's jump back for a second here. So how did you get your engineering chops? Because you went from your own home studio, basically, did you have a mentor? Did you just learn it on your own? By osmosis? And lots of people do it that way, but how did that work for you?
I just did it the old-fashioned way, by trial and error. And it was really weird, but unfortunate. And I had a really good conversation a couple of years ago with my good friend of mine, Steve McMillan. And we were talking about our styles of how we worked, because Steve started up in the studio system as a second engineer. And I wasn't that lucky. I was never able to be a second engineer for someone. I just came in as a first, because I'd been working on everybody else's projects. I owned my own studios. So, you know, I was like, dude, I would love to have been in some of the sessions that you've been in. He's like, yeah, but you know, the downside is that, you know, I learned good and bad from everybody else's mistakes. You had your own sound and your own unique thing that you were doing. He goes, which is why your stuff, your mixes, you know, didn't sound like everybody else's, which is awesome. So I learned the old fashioned way, which, you know, school of hard knocks, if you will. But it just kind of worked for me. I did a lot of audio video stuff when I was in college, and just jumped out and started buying my first studio we had was a 16 track, 1-inch Atari MX-70 and the Trident Series 65.
No.
And, you know, jumped from there into a Neve, and from a Neve, and, you know, kept going up the line.
Yeah. Oh, very cool. Well, I'm like you. I didn't start in the business as an assistant, and yet, like you, I look back and go, boy, I really missed some things that could have been really valuable. And when I talk to my friends that have come up through the system and they tell some of the stories, it's like, I missed all that, for better or for worse. But
so true.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Well, okay, let's jump to the present here. So what's your studio like today? Is the studio in your house, or is it separate?
Well, the studio was in my house. I built a studio. I got tired of... I got tired of doing long stretches down at Westlake, and I love Westlake. I was in Studio A in 1999 for almost 4 days straight. I think I was only out of the studio for 2 hours a night. And that was just to go to the lobby. I mean, we pretty much camped out there. And I just thought, this is no way for me to live. I was never seeing my kids. This is just not cool. So I decided I was going to build a home studio at the time. And just gut my garage and build it the way I wanted to and take my time. So all of 99, I designed and built my room. And I thought I would just have a couple of overdub sessions or maybe, some mix up from time to time. But I bought Pro Tools, which back then was Pro Tools 5, I think. We may have just upgraded to Pro Tools 5. And I was heavy using radar at the time. It was the Radar 1s back in the day. And I had a Mackie digital 8 bus. And my first client in the studio was Backstreet Boys.
Wow.
So we had the first project we had, we recorded them over at Sonora, and we had like 4 days to get 5 mixes done on these songs because they were shooting a video to something like on a Friday. And I basically just stayed home, stayed in the garage. And I can't even remember the mastering engineer's name, but I made a delivery, got everything down there for mastering. And he was like, "Did you just finish this over at Larrabee?" And I said, "Dude, I've been working in my garage for like 4 days." I literally just finished this. He's like, "No way these mixes came out of your garage." And I was like, "Why?" He goes, I've done precious little to them. I'm like, "What did you do?" He goes, "I added a dB at 16K. And I'm like, "No way."
Wow.
He's like, "Yeah." Wow. He goes, "On some of these songs, I added a half a dB at 16K. And I'm like, "No way." So that was the first step of knowing that I was, that studio was going to be just right for me. I built it from the ground up just the way I wanted. And I just slowly took my time with it, and it was everything I wanted. It's when I was done with that, I jumped into a 2.5 year project with Kenny Loggins. And we worked on that until 2003 and took the weekend off and then jumped into a Whitney Houston project, a Christmas project. Then took that until the end of the year. I mean, it was literally just one of those things back to back to back to back. And I hadn't really planned on working that much in that room, but the sound that I was getting in that room and the reliability of the product I was getting out of my room was just like, wow. People were, Kenny would come over and say, "Well, there's just no point in booking any other place. Just cut all the vocals here. Let's do the guitar overdubs here. Let's do this over here." And pretty soon we were doing, once we'd done the tracking, we pretty much just stayed in the room the rest of the time. So it's a great room.
When I used to see you at Front Page, what were you working on then? What project or projects? Because you used to come in and use the Euphonics a lot. And
Euphonics. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I thought that you owned one, which is why you knew it so well. Was that the case?
Stephen Bray had, I worked with Stephen Bray, who owned Saturn Sound.
Yeah, yeah.
For a couple of years, 4 or 5 years. And Stephen had a Euphonics in his B room. He had a Neve VR 60 in the A room. And in the B room, he had the Euphonics. And I pretty much camped out, and that was my room. So I knew that room intimately. And I knew that board intimately. So I would bounce around. When that room got booked out occasionally, I would bounce around, or if somebody else needed something else, I would go over to Front Page. Because there were only a couple of places in town that had Euphonics.
Yeah, right.
I love those boards. They were great boards. But yeah, that's why it was at the time, it was Radars and Euphonics.
Yeah.
And that was that, I could go anywhere with those because it would interchange. I shouldn't just say that because I was a Neve guy, hands down, but I was one of, Stephen Bray and I were one of the early adopters of Euphonics consoles. And the next thing that we knew, we were on, the ads for Euphonics, and just, you know, just ads for Euphonics and Radars. And it was just like one of those kind of things where it's like, wow, this is really, it was a great combination of sound between the two. I love the combination between the two. But yeah, when Saturn was booked, I would always pop over to Front Page.
Okay. Now I get it. Now I see what happened. Yeah, because you'd be in for a few days and then you'd be gone and then I wouldn't see you for a bit and then you'd come back and, you know, then I'd see mm-hmm. you'd pop in and out frequently. Isn't mm-hmm. So then you built the studio in your garage. Is that still what you're mm-hmm. using?
No. Thanks to the divorce, I just moved out of there 2 months ago.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
So it's what happened.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's so interesting because I saw you recently at Vincent's funeral.
Yeah.
And Vincent was an absolute sweetheart. And when I was building my room, I remember I had designed almost everything in the room. And I was just down to the doors of the room. And I had known Vincent from Stephen Bray's room because he had designed all of Saturn Sound. And I said to my wife at the time, I said, I really would love to be able to have Vincent's doors. I mean, I love his rooms. I would love to have his doors. And she said, why don't you just call him and ask him? And I said, nah, he's... I couldn't afford it. Even I could. It wouldn't happen. So being, you know, a great wife, she just was just like, she was like, yeah, okay, whatever. So she called Stephen, got Vincent's number. And she said, my husband absolutely loves and adores your rooms from A&M on out. And he's been bragging about your doors. And I was just wondering what it would take to have you design the doors for his room. And Vincent, you know, just sweet as he could be, said, do you have a fax machine? And she said, yeah. He goes, give me have your fax number. And within 10 minutes, he was like, I'm going to just fax over the plans for the doors and you guys can follow the plans. It's my little gift to you.
Wow.
And I just thought, my God. And everybody who would come in, you know, for our quote unquote home studio, people would be like, oh my God, these doors are fantastic. Like, Vincent Van Hoff, he was the sweetest guy in the world. And so at his funeral or his memorial service the other day, people were talking about these temples of sound that we all, you know, go to work in every day. And we have the privilege of creating music in that hopefully will last for generations to come. And I was telling somebody when I got out of there, I think it was Barry Rudolph. I said, you know, I was content with just having like a little room, but I just feel like it's time for me. I'm only 53. It's time to build another temple of sound
mm-hmm.
because I love what I do. I love the fact that I have the privilege of working in this business. And I feel it's important to really get what we do right. It's not brain surgery, no. But when I see how what we do really can change the lives of others down the road, and I've had people tell me that, you know, man, I listen to the song you mix and just it touched my heart, it touched my soul. And it's like, wow, I can't stop creating music. I know that sounds maybe cliche, but it's important for us to get back to creating great music. And at some point, you know, in the next year, I'm got to find a place that, I mean, I have a temporary place now, but I'm looking at building another temple of sound that really is just, you know, someplace that great music can come out of for years to come.
And are you looking for just a big control room or a tracking room, or what are you looking for?
Well, that's a good question, Bobby. I really feel like I could overdub most of what I'm looking for in probably like a 1,500 square foot space.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I've got a guy, Raul Ferrando, who we've been doing work together since Sonora days. He's an amazing orchestrator. And he's been doing a whole bunch of stuff. And he called me up the other day and he said, I know you're looking for another room. We should go in and find like a 3,000 or 4,000 square foot building and just go in on it together and build another, you know, a studio for you and a studio for me in the same square footage, and we'll split the place. And I'm like, dude, let's do that.
Yeah.
So that's where my brain has been. Because most of the places, you know, a lot of the places that we all, you know, are used to have either gone private or they're gone and there's a condo there now, or, you know, or they want like, you know, $4 million for a room. It's like, dude, I don't need a $4 million room anymore. Sorry. Yeah. I just don't.
Yeah.
You know, you start talking to some of these guys and it's like, yeah, someone's got a place and they want $2.9 million. I'm like, I don't need a $2.9 million room. Thanks.
Well, the world has changed.
Really solid control.
And yeah. Well, hey, look, if you can get what you got from a Mackie Digital 8 bus, then, you know, again, you don't have limitations on you like a lot of people do in terms of gear. You know, you're not relying on gear. That's not a factor anymore.
Yeah. And to be honest, I mean, you know, I there are certain places I go to for tracking. And when I'm done tracking, I can overdub and mix at my place. That's the way it was with my studio for 16 years.
Yeah.
I would go in because Stag was literally like right up the street from me. And I would go over to Melody's room over, you know, at Stag. And, you know, they've got an API and great microphones.
Yeah.
I love that place. I'd go in, track, and then overdub and mix in my place. And, you know, it would be awesome. So I think I, you know, still utilizing, and I've told this to a lot of other people, still utilizing a lot of what we do in this industry, you know, and reach out to other rooms and just, you know, do basic tracking in those other rooms. And then go to your own places and overdub and mix, you
but
know?
Isn't that the way of the world now, though? I mean, it seems like everybody does that. And not too many people camp out in a big room for a whole project anymore. Even if you have the budget for it, people would rather just track and then go back to their own rooms. Because if you have enough money that you can be in a big room in an East-West or a Henson or something like that for a whole project, then you have enough that you can build your own.
That's true. No, that's true. But, you know, it's so weird because there was a time when you would have actual budget, you know, to work on stuff like that.
Yeah.
And nowadays, there's just no budget. There's no industry left. I mean, it's sad to say, but, you know, the industry has just fallen off a cliff. And I don't see how it gets its way back to where it was. So this is our new normal that we have now.
Yeah. I want to touch on something before I forget here. Your summing mixer. How did that come about?
Well, I've been looking at doing something like this for a number of years. I met, when I was working on that Whitney Houston album, Reggie Hamilton came over and brought with him what looked like a fire hydrant to me. And I was like, dude, where'd you get the fire hydrant from? He's like, dude, this is my new DI. It's called a Reddy. You got to check it out. And I'm like, okay, plug it in. Let's go. And we used it on that session for Whitney. There's like five or six songs we recorded that day. And I was like, you got to introduce me to this company. This is, you know, the Reddy is amazing. And he introduced me to a guy named Peter Montesi, who had A Designs Audio.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter, you know, Peter is out there in West Hills, and I was in Van Nuys. And, you know, we became good friends. And Pete said, listen, I've got some gear I want you to beat up on and just tell me what you think about it. So I started beta testing his stuff for him. And like, well, this is like cool. This is cool. It'd be great if you could change this. This is wonderful. And so we developed this friendship. And about 6 or 7 years ago, I said, I want to put out a box with my name on it. He goes, well, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to do a summing mixer. It's really what I want to do. Because things were heading that way. And at the time, I had used Paul Wolf's Tone Lux stuff for years.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to Peter, and I said, I really want to do this. This is like maybe a year and a half ago. I said, I really want to do this, and I really want to do this with Paul Wolf. And we all sat down at dinner and worked it out on paper. And my concept was pretty straightforward. And Paul was like, we could do this. We had a prototype up and running in 6 months. And I think the box starts shipping in 2 weeks.
Oh, no kidding. Oh, it's that close.
No kidding.
Very cool.
It's that close. And I've been doing cartwheels. It's being manufactured here in Alhambra. And Raymond Liu is knocking out all the building of the boxes. We've got 4 beta boxes out there now, and all the people who've been beta testing it have come back. Dylan Dresdow, who does the Black Eyed Peas, Black Eyed Peas, I shouldn't call them the, but he does Black Eyed Peas, and he was doing a simultaneous in the box and a summing mix at the same time. And he sent 5 or 6 mixes to the record company. And he says, just 2 mixes of the same song, pick whichever one you like. And I think out of the 5 mixes he sent them, every time they picked the Mix Factory mixes.
Wow.
Hands down. And he said, dude, I got to tell you, I don't really do summing, but I got to tell you, this box sounds amazing. It's open. It's wide. He said, it's everything that you're expecting analog to be. It is amazing.
Was he putting anything else on it outside the box, compressors, or was this just through the box, through the summing mixer?
Just through the summing mixer. He was just doing it. He was routing 16 channels out and summing.
Wow.
But the box has, there's a couple of unique features about the box. One is that you've got 16 channels of summing, and there's a transformer in there, a custom wound Cinemag transformer. So you can either have a very kind of neutral sound that, if you've been recording with a lot of great iron, it's not necessary all the time to have a transformer on your two bus. So a lot of guys don't necessarily have to have that, but a lot of guys don't have that luxury, and they have like an inbox or something close to it that allows you to have that kind of transformer sound on that two bus. And it just instantly, as soon as you press it in, it instantly just comes forward. It's got that sound that, the only steel can bring you from a steel transformer. And then on top of that, you've got the possibility of linking them. And we've taken like all 4 boxes of our betas and we've linked them all together. So you can dump one into the other, into the other, into the other. And so, 16, 32, you can keep going.
Yeah, yeah.
I think, well, we've only done the 4 together so far, but they're all linkable. And you've got a pan and a fader on each channel, which is great. Because,
mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's not always left, right. And sometimes you want, like the way I work is all of my bottom end stuff comes out of 5 and 6. All my vocals come out 3 and 4. All of my guitars come out 7 and 8. And everything's kind of prescribed like where I want them to go. Because there are certain outboard boxes that they go through before they hit the mixer.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of guys I've talked to are like, they always want their bottom end to be like a little hotter. So they'll turn it up, a little beyond unity gain. So it's kind of cool that because you've got pan and fader on each channel, and not every summing mixer has that. So there's a couple of features on it that really just sonically, we've had at least 6 or 7 people beta test them, and they've just been flipping out about the box. So we're really excited.
What's the price on it?
I think they're streeting for $25.
Okay. Yeah, well, that's in the ballpark. Sure.
Yeah, because I think the Dangerous, we had a guy who tried it against the Dangerous. He had a Dangerous. He bought the first one. He bought one of the betas. He saw it at NAMM, flipped out, and was like, dude, I'll just buy one of the betas, please. I really want one. To me, a great mix has not only a front to back, but, you've got to feel that depth. How far back does that reverb feel like it? Does it feel like it's like, sitting 10 feet behind you, or is it right there in your face? How wide is that mix? Does it feel like it's super wide, or is it super narrow? And do you feel that kick way down at the bottom? Do you feel the strings up top? To me, a mix has to be three-dimensional, and that's what this box has. It has a wonderful analog, you know, three-dimensional sound. And, you know, I mixed for a long time, you know, in the box, you know, and then finally I just stepped out of the box and started doing a hybrid thing where it was part, you know, I would use the plugins from inside Pro Tools, but then I would sum out. And this box has just been great for that.
When you were mixing in the box, were you still mixing to multiple buses, multiple subgroups, so to speak, where you had, I think you said you had your low end on one bus and then you had the vocals on another. And did you do that before you actually started to come outside the box?
No, I didn't. And I did for a long time when I was just mixing in the box. I just slapped every plugin in the world on my two bus, and then I just printed, I recorded to disc. I took that output and I recorded on a individual audio track, and then I recorded to disc. I never bounced to disc. Because it had a particular sound, and then, you know, this is back in the 5.1 days with Digi, the bounce to disc didn't sound, in my opinion, right.
Yeah.
So I would always record the disc, and I just got in the habit of doing that. And then I was working on a client who just ripped me off completely. He had me do his single, and I did the single, and I sent him back the entire mix, and he's like, this is awesome. But I got a call about 2 or 3 weeks later from an assistant who worked for them. And he said, what plugin did you use on the vocal? I was like, why do you need to know that? And he goes, oh, because they want me to take, you know, the assistant, but they want me to take all the rest of the mixes and then to plug them into what you've done on your mix.
Oh.
Because they tracked them all the same.
Yeah.
So they're just using import session data, and we're just going across and just duplicating everything you did in your original mixes, and then we're just doing fader moves. And I'm like, wow.
That's low.
So, oh my gosh, I was blown away. So I started incorporating, I remember really well, I went to Peter Montesi and I said, I need like a killer box for like, you know, something I can run my vocals through, something that's an external EQ. At a time he had just released the Hammer EQ.
Mm-hmm.
And, I started using that on all of my vocals. And to this day, I still do. I've got two Hammers, one on the guitars. Guitars and strings have come out of output 7, and one on the vocals. And all my vocals go through those boxes. And I've also got various other EQs. I've got the A-Designed EMEQ2, which is a Pultec type EQ, but doesn't have tubes in it. And I love that because I've got that on my two bus, and it takes a huge crunch. Because, you know, a conventional Pultec, if you push it too far on a two bus, it starts to collapse. The tubes start going, hey, whoa.
Yeah.
Not so with this. It has a sound, but it doesn't fall apart when you start pushing stuff. And I love that box. And then I've got the Nail compressor on there, which is fantastic in so many ways. And then the output of all that runs into the mix factory. I take the output of that and then I go into the head, which is the Crane Song head.
Right.
And I've got some tape emulation on that. So the days nowadays, sure, I can give you back the session and they'll call up the session. It's like, it doesn't sound the same. It's like, well, there's about 12 other boxes that you're missing, that you're never going to be able to duplicate because they're my boxes. They're near my settings. And that's what started me on this, that journey of like, let me find something else that will work for me.
Yeah. Makes perfect sense.
Just got tired of getting ripped off, dude.
Yeah. No, I hear you. Definitely. Tell me about your record label.
Breath of Life Records. So I always wanted to do a record label, and I've been saying I wanted to do it for years and years and years. And I worked with Mervyn Warren for 19 years. After he left Take Six, I've worked with him. We've done tons of movies and tons of projects together. And 6 years ago, I said to him, I think we did the Queen Latifah Super Bowl. I think it was either Queen Latifah or Faith Hill. One of those two. We did one of the Super Bowls where we had done stuff for her. And I said, this is the last project I'm going to work with you on. He's like, you're kidding, right? And I'm like, no, I need to concentrate. And I was coming up on like 47. I was like, I'm creeping up towards 50. If I don't start this record label before I turn 50, I will never get this done. And so I had a couple of friends who I've been talking about doing this for a long time with. One of them was Eric Looper. And I had a childhood friend named Dr. Pamela Allen. And I was telling them, this is what I want to do. I'm going to sign X, Y, and Z. And I have this vision for creating great music. And I really want to do this. And Pam was like, we should do this. We should jump on this. Why you still, want to do it? And so we've got six acts on the label, three of which are doing jazz or jazz based music. Shalaya is probably our halo act. She just finished playing the White House for the second time a couple of weeks ago. Mm. And has done very well. In fact, she's doing some stuff with Stevie Wonder right now. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
For Stevie's new project. So we're really excited, and Stevie just thinks the world of her. But we are really excited because all of our artists are a little different in terms of what they bring to the table. I've hand-selected every artist who's been signed to the label. So we've got Justin Wilson, who is just a beast on keys. And his Christmas album is just a classic Christmas album. Rebecca Adriel, who's working on her project. Josie Aiello, who was signed to Quest a couple of years ago, 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And we hand-selected Natalie Cadet, who is just climbing up the charts with her single, Take Five, which is her take on the Take Five classic with Dave Brubeck.
Mm.
And it's really doing well. And, like I said, I've hand-selected all the artists so that nobody steps in anybody else's lane. Everybody's really unique and different how they present themselves and their artistry. So it's pretty exciting. I'm really excited. And they're doing really well as artists.
Is that what you're spending?
As well as can be expected in this crazy industry.
Is that what you're spending all of your time on now?
Pretty much, yeah.
Recording and mixing that you're doing is mostly for them.
Well, it was mostly for them, but now we're at the point where, we had overlapping projects at one time where I was mixing one project for Josie because we had the Heavyweights produce their project. I was just mixing Josie's project.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were finishing up Natalie's project and we were still in the depth of Shalaya doing stuff. She was coming off of tour doing stuff with Stevie Wonder. And then it was one of those weird things where I was juggling three projects at the same time. So I just didn't have time to work with anybody else.
Yeah, yeah.
But now that those albums are out and done, we're just down to one. I think Shalaya's got one duet left to do with Stevie and a duet to do with Babyface. And once those two are done, so I've slowly, over the last 2 months, started to move back into production and that stuff that's not mine. And I've got like four album projects right now that I'm mixing for other people who I have nothing to do with other than mixing their projects.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's cool.
So it's great. Yeah, it's great. I mean, I love the fact that, I've been blessed to have a reputation enough to kind of say, okay, well, I'm back at it. And people are like, dude, can you mix this project? Can you mix this? Can you? And I get a lot of calls from people who are singers, and they have, I have a fairly good reputation for cutting vocals. It started with Take Six, of course, doing stuff with those guys. But, it's just a nice thing to be able to say, you know, I'm ready to go back to work. And people were like, hey, great. Can we get back to work? Can you cut this in and mix the album?
Yeah. So
it's a blessing. Yeah.
Yeah. That's awesome, Tony. Last question. What is the best piece of business advice that you learned along the way, or maybe somebody imparted to you?
Wow. The best piece of business advice. Wow.
Or the best advice in general.
Wow. You know, it's interesting. I would say the best advice is probably just don't believe your own hype. It doesn't make a difference how good people tell you are. Get better at your craft.
Yeah.
Just get better at it. And I know so many guys who you know, at a certain point in this industry, they just feel like they're at the top and they can't get any better. You know, get better at your craft every day.
Yeah.
What we do is just, we create art. And there's always a new way to stretch your artist palette and to become better at the art that you're creating. So, you know, just because you've been doing the same thing for 15, 20 years, mix it up, change it. You know, you have a sound. Most engineers, you know, have a particular sound. That's why people go to them.
Yeah.
They have this sound for this or this sound for this. Don't get locked into that sound. Change up your sound a bit because it keeps you fresh and it keeps you on your toes musically so that you can do something like, wow, dude, that's you, but that's like you with a spin. But that's really cool. You know, if you've been in the box all this time, put a piece of analog gear in it. If you've been out of the box, try an in-the-box mix. If you know, mix it up. Learn to push yourself so that you grow as an artist in this industry. It's everything we've got.
To find out more about Tony, go to themixfactory.com. That's all one word, themixfactory, one word, .com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or you can go to bobbyoinnercircle.com or find an iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.